Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, other stuff at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, Melody Lauer.
Hello. Wait, no, that wasn't how I did it.
Hello.
Hello. I need to watch Mr. Doubtfire. That would be an interesting twist if they like redid the video and had it a woman being Mr. Doubtfire.
Well, now, see, I'm glad you said this on air because like in 10, 15 years when Hollywood gets to newer movies to remake because they've run out of ideas,
right.
We can be like, hey, you stole this idea from us. Give us $100,000.
Maybe we could sue.
That's what I just said.
Well, yeah. Okay.
Hey, patent pending. Yes.
Thank you, Joe.
Yes. Hey, guess what?
What's that, John?
This segment brought to you by Lucky Gunner and Federal Premium Ammunition. Whether there was a firefight or you do, in fact, want to worry about that little guy, you need more ammo. And when it's time to restock, you can't beat Federal Premium Ammunition and LuckyGunner.com. With a shipping department that's always moving at 88 miles per hour, if I order a case of American Eagle from Lucky Gunner on a Thursday, it's at my doorstep ready to shoot before the weekend starts. Head to LuckyGunner.com today to check out their in-stock lineup of Federal Premium Ammunition. And remember, unless you're on fire or drowning, you can never really have too much ammo.
I have to almost, I've been thinking, ever since you've written this ad, I've been thinking of how I can come up with a way that that's not true. I think I found one. When you have bad knees and you have to, like, walk around with a ton of ammo on your back.
So it's a Facebook user question episode.
I tried. You didn't disagree, so I'm right.
Well, I'm just like, why are you invalidating the ad, Melody?
I'm not. It's a very good ad. And I agree. Lucky Gunner is amazing. We should all buy more ammo from them.
That wasn't heavy-handed at all. So, we are answering your questions that you have submitted via Facebook, which is another reason to like the Facebook page.
You get your questions answered.
Plus, the comments are generally, not always, generally semi-safe to read because I rule with an iron fist and ban people when they're... No, actually, I don't ban people for being dumb. But anyway... I think our audience is a relatively educated audience, and I'm proud of you guys.
It's a decent audience.
So, questions.
All right. David Blanton asked, do you ever favor speed over accuracy, specifically choosing a 4-inch gun because it comes out of the holster quicker versus a 4.5 or 5-inch gun that will hit, he says, faster at distance?
I'm just going to answer the question that he asked and not speak to some of the other things. But me personally, no. I mean, I'm carrying a Glock 34 right now. So just because I like the longer sight radius and I like the recoil characteristics better than I do on like a G17. I've not found any reduction in overall speed just because of the longer barrel, just because of how I carry and how I draw the gun. I think that people that think guns come out of the holster quicker if they're shorter guns are carrying very specific ways or utilizing draw techniques that are not ones that I utilize. Because I'm drawing straight up to like a number two position and then... traversing the gun from vertical to horizontal. So the length of the barrel doesn't matter as much. I mean, if I were carrying something ridiculous like a Super Blackhawk or something like that with like an 8.5-inch barrel, then yeah, okay, that matters. But the difference between like 4 to 5, 5.25, not very significant in my experience.
I have a small caveat to that.
Sure.
When I was carrying 1911s almost exclusively, and I would try to carry a 5-inch 1911 versus like a 3-inch 1911, particularly on the hip, my torso is so short that that inch, I couldn't get my shoulder up high enough.
Right.
But like you said before, that's a very specific carry position with a very, you know, that could have been mitigated with a different holster or, you know. But in the appendix position, I have not found that to be a problem because I have a lot more range of motion in my shoulder. So there are, you know.
Yeah, and it, like I said, it depends on. So one
body
of the,
type.
And, yeah, it depends on a bunch of stuff. You know, and that's what a lot of people, it's like, that's a question, like, I'd love to give you an answer, but it depends, you know? So, yeah. Anyway, I'd probably carry a G19 sized gun if the grip were larger, just because I actually like the slide velocity you get with like the shorter guns. But a G19 grip does not work for me because my hands are too big. So anyway, next question.
Okay, Tim Reedy asked, how much and what kind of experience should a student have drawing from a holster before an instructor feels comfortable recommending AIWB along with AIWB specific training?
Man, that's a really... I've kind of come full circle on this because the general wisdom has always been that AIWB is for, you know, for very experienced firearms people, right? I think if someone gets quality instruction right off the bat, and if they are the type of person that can treat it with the gravity it deserves all the time, starting with AIWB is sort of making more sense to me because you are much more aware of where your muzzle was pointed at when you were reholstering. It is much easier to see if anything has made its way into your holster. So when you reholster, it's easier to look the gun into the holster. And honestly, you're much less likely to muzzle someone standing next to you on a line when you reholster or draw the gun. So, I mean, I don't know what the answer is. Yeah, I don't think I have fully formed my opinions as far as, you know, what I want the, you know, what I'm going to recommend from here on out. But I think you could make the case for starting people with AIWB as long as they were starting with quality instruction. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, and I think the other thing that some people forget, too, is that due to body types, injuries, mobility, all those kinds of things, there are some people where the only place that they can carry effectively, really, is AIWB.
Right.
And whether they have experience drawing from the holster or not, that's where you got to start them. And you just have to teach them right instead of being like, oh, well, you don't have enough experience to holster here yet, so therefore, you know. You got to kind of tailor it to the people who need it.
Well, and the other issue becomes too, I think that this whole conversation about, well, it's safer to ND behind the hip is starting with a base assumption that someone is going to ND. And I think that right there is a failure in thinking to begin with.
Well, and I see, honestly, more egregious gun handling sometimes trying to reholster or holster in general behind the hip than I do AIWB.
Yeah.
And you talked to that a little bit as far as people having a little bit, are a little more mindful of the AIWB position when maybe they should be a little more mindful of behind the hip as well.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. So We got about a minute left in this segment, so
here's a quick one. James Yates, do you use visualization when learning new techniques or for improving overall shooting ability? Or was that not quick?
Man, I know there's a lot of value to it. I am very lucky that I generally just get to go do stuff, so I'm not limited necessarily by like resource as far as like ammo or time or ranges. So not really, but that's not to say that you shouldn't. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
My looking at an outlier and then trying to like gauge the mean or median is probably not good. And I just stole that from Carl Wren. He said it in a group we're in. But anyway, we're answering your questions. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the new EDC X9, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match-grade accuracy, superior ergonomics and concealability, with modern service pistol capacity, 15 rounds, and reliability at www.wilsoncombat.com. So, we are answering your questions. It is a Facebook user question episode, for our first one in a while, actually.
Yeah, it actually is.
So, show me what you got.
Okay.
That was a Rick and Morty reference.
I don't watch Rick and Morty.
I know.
Whoa. It's too repetitive for me. Drives me crazy. Anyway.
It's only the first season or so. There's less of that. Hey, Melody, ask me the next question, Melody.
I'm going to. Oh,
thanks,
stop.
Melody.
Really? I will walk out that door.
Hey, Joe, do you want to co-host a show? No? Okay.
Then you should stop.
I should stop.
Stephen Estel says, when training as someone with astigmatism, bad eyesight in general, do you always train with your corrective lenses or not?
That was me making a sound of, I don't know how I want to answer this question. So recently, I usually wear contact lenses. Had some eye problems the other week and couldn't, so I was shooting in glasses. And my eyes are bad. I mean, really bad. And I was shooting glasses. I also shot a little bit without glasses. I could still hit stuff just fine. I mean, well, not as well as I can when I can actually see stuff, but like as far as hitting a target, I can do that man-sized target out to 25 yards, even blind as a bat. That part's easy. What becomes problematic is identifying a threat. So the question of whether or not you should train without your prescriptive lenses, I think you should do it once or twice just to have experience with it in case something weird happens. But as far as should you spend a lot of time on it, no, because honestly, the issue becomes positively identifying a threat to you more so than can I hit this thing? And when I think about like trying to ID a threat, if there's like more than one person present, I'm not going to be shooting it much past a couple of feet at that point, just because my eyes aren't good enough to separate people, you know, and see what they're doing. So that's kind of where I'm at on that. Do you have any thoughts? Because you're not as blind as a bat.
No, and honestly, I actually do a lot of shooting without my glasses, just because I don't have that same problem. I lose fine details once we get past, you know, 10, 15 yards, but target identification is not a problem, but I might not have, you know, extreme precision that I could have with corrective lenses. So I get away with it a lot more than other people do. So when people see me shooting without my glasses, they're like, well, and it's entirely dependent upon how bad is your vision. You know, I can pass my driver's test, you know, the driver's screening. So technically, by law, I don't need glasses. I just like them because it fine-tunes my vision. That doesn't mean that you, who is as blind as a bat without glasses, should be walking around shooting without your glasses.
I think I'm blinder than a bat, actually. And I don't have, like, the cool echolocation going on for me.
That would be cool.
Yeah, so.
Okay. Tamara Keel asked, does post-Jedi JJRG have a different view of slide-mounted MRDS compared to pre-Jedi JJRG?
So... Let me interpret. Yeah, let me translate that. So we went and took a red dot pistol class with Scott Jedlinski, affectionately known as Jedi. I have picked up the JJRG nickname many years ago from a friend of mine. Anyway, so what Tam is asking is, do I have a different opinion on the red dot now that I went and worked with someone that's really good at shooting red dots, or am I kind of whatever? No, I still don't like them that much for me personally. I think maybe if I really spent a ton of time with them, I could get pretty good with them. But what I find for me is that I become too visually aware of the sights, which is the opposite of what most people want. So it's not a bad thing, but for me personally, I'm paying too much attention to the sights. I start chasing the dot around. I start over confirming a sight picture and then, missing. So, or taking more time. That having been said, I think that once the technology, probably another generation or so, is there, I know for a fact that it's the way of the future. So getting in early is not a bad idea. And honestly, if I were going to start new shooters out, like a brand new shooter, I might start them on a dot at this point, just because it's one less thing. I don't have to explain sight alignment to them. I just have to explain trigger press. It's like, here, put the dot over top of this, press the trigger cleanly, have a good grip, bam, there you go. So there are advantages in certain situations. The idea that people have that they can't be fast close is false. And I think that was kind of eye-opening for me, as far as Scott talks a lot about the amount of slop someone will allow for iron sights that they don't then allow for a red dot, as far as like people over-confirm the dot, I guess. So was my opinion changed? Yes. Has it changed anything for how I do things? No, not right now, but maybe in the future. So I'm getting there. That's kind of where I'm at with it.
Sounds good. Nigel Benson asked, do you see any utility in keeping a magwell on a carry gun?
I like them because they actually force my grip a little bit higher onto the gun, and they sort of lock my hand in better on the gun. The issue with a lot of, not all, but a lot of magwells is that if you have to strip a stuck magazine from one and you've not gotten the right magwell, right base plate combination, it can be really, really tough. We had somebody discover that in class this last, well, by the time this episode airs, it will...
Couple weeks ago.
We'll actually be teaching a class this weekend, and oh god, we're time traveling again. Or maybe it was last. Anyway, comes up in every class. Someone's got a magwell on the gun. They go to strip a magazine to clear a malfunction, and they're like, "Well, crap." So yeah, if you want to carry one, that's cool. Reloads don't really happen that much for private citizens, especially not in public, but. Are there advantages to having one? Yes, just make sure that you have considered all the ways that the magwell might negatively impact you as well, you know? So, and make sure that you can strip a stuck mag. If you can't, then you probably need to change your base plates out, change your magwell out, or not have one. So there you go.
All right, then. Med kits. Do you suggest a trunk kit? A kit in the passenger compartment, or some on your person, or something like a dark trauma kit in the passenger compartment, good enough? I'm guessing, is it something good enough? Obviously, training is needed with any kit.
Who was that question from?
Oh, Matt Boardman. I'm sorry, Matt.
It's okay. I'll answer, and then I'd like the EMT Melody to answer as well. I've got a tourniquet on my person. I've got a med kit that is in a fanny pack buckled to the back of my passenger headrest so I can access it with one hand, assuming that the passenger seat is still there. But we got about 30, 40 seconds left. What do you think, Melody?
I think gear that you have on you is always going to trump gear that's in a car, especially in a trunk. Things that are in your passenger compartment are good, but they have to be secured, like what you're doing.
Right. So, yeah. Anyway, we're answering your questions. It's a Facebook user question episode, and you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it. And that's where Surefire comes in. From the USB rechargeable 300 lumen Sidekick to the 500 lumen X300 Ultra or M600 Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, Aziz, light! Ever again. Doesn't matter if you're shining a light at a potential threat or just helping your friends see through their eyelids. When you need all the lumens for longer, you need Surefire. And now, as a special offer to Ballistic Radio listeners, you can get 30% off the Surefire.com web store, everything except batteries and suppressors, by entering the discount code ALLTHELUMENS, that is ALLTHELUMENS, at Surefire.com. So, we're answering your questions. It's a Facebook user question extravaganza.
Indeed it is.
And Melody's got more questions.
I do. I saved this one because I knew you were going to talk about it. John Mayers. Do you ever use a soft sight picture technique a la Proctor, Seeklander, etc.? Looking at the entire sight picture as a package, soft focus on the rear, front, and target. Or do you always use a hard front sight focus?
It depends on the distance. So I am generally a soft sight. So honestly, what I call it is target focus. I generally do that out to about 15, 20 yards. And then that's about when I'll start to pay more attention to the front sight, make sure that it is more prevalent in my mind and also in my visual field as far as what I'm paying attention to. That's going to depend on your own personal skill level, and it's going to depend on the size and distance that the target is at. So what I suggest people do is, you know, start at like 3 yards, and you're looking at the sights with both of these, so know that. Get a hard, you know, pick like an 8-inch circle maybe with a dot in the center of it so you have a center aiming point. Try a hard front sight focus at 3 yards, then try target focus, and just do that as a walk back to like, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25 yards and see what you can do and not do.
All right, then. Brian Sheets asked, what drills or qualifications, such as a dot torture, do you recommend a shooter returning to periodically to evaluate their progress or areas that need work as a shooter?
So the one, there's a couple that I use. Dot torture, I don't know that that's a good, like, session-to-session evaluation so much as it's a good way to force focus and patience. What I use a lot are build drills, failure drills, and also fast tests. So those are the ones that I kind of keep going back to as far as, because I think they also do draws to, like, you know, just single draws to a 3x5 card, you know, at varying distances, because I think that those more closely represent the skills that we need to have as, you know, armed citizens carrying a gun concealed. Now, if you're a cop or in the military, different things will be more useful to you or less useful to you. It really, you know, your mission does really change the skills that you need to work on, you know. So it's kind of where I'm at. I mean, even the fast, I don't run too often. I'm running it a lot right now just because I'm going to be trying for a fast coin here shortly. I'm like in my head trying to do the math as far as when this episode's airing. I'm like, did I already try? I don't know. Anyway, so confusing. But that's kind of where I'm at with that. So how about you, Melody? What do you work on?
I think the super test is a good one.
Oh, that's another one.
If you're just looking at like, hey, because that tests kind of all over. It tests your speed. It tests your accuracy. It tests your command of your pistol. And it really tests your consistency and whether or not you're actually improving or you're just kind of plateauing.
Well, and the nice thing is like a lot of these things you can make more difficult by... you know, running it
decreasing time,
running it from concealment. Yeah, stuff like that. So super test, another one that I've been working on.
Making the target smaller.
Yeah, right.
That was a big one.
I ran a 297 on a super. I ran two in a row the last time you and I ran it together, and I'm just like, well, now I want 300. We'll see. So.
All right. Billy Buell says, fiber optic sights when paired with a weapon-mounted light. Does the fiber optic pick up enough light for a clear sight picture?
It depends on the ambient light conditions more than it does a weapon-mounted light. So what a lot of people confuse about a weapon-mounted light is all the light from the weapon-mounted light is going forward of the weapon, right? At least on a handgun for the most part. And none of it's getting on the sight. So if you're in a dark area and you hit something with a light and can positively identify it, if you don't have any ambient light wherever you are, then what you're going to see is pretty much just silhouette of the rear, silhouette of the front. If you have tritium, you might see that. It kind of depends, but as far as, you know, picking up like a fiber optic, you won't see it unless the lighting conditions are favorable. It's kind of one of those things where the advantage to like the handheld to the weapon mounted light, other than not having to point a gun at what I'm pointing the light at, is that if you utilize proper light technique, you can actually illuminate your own sights while you're illuminating the target, which is kind of nice. That having been said, I mean, you can get really good hits not seeing the fiber, because honestly, at that point, it's just, you know, black iron sights, and that's been working well for a long time for a lot of people. So that kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always kind of like, did I explain that well? I don't know if I did or not.
Well, I'm a bad judge probably, but okay. Nathan Parker.
Yes.
Says, what are your thoughts on the community's fascination with aftermarket triggers on striker-fired guns? And where is the line between provides useful performance and being better off just learning how to shoot the gun better?
I don't know. So I run SSVI tier triggers on pretty much all of my Glocks, mainly because I like the shape of the trigger shoe. Much better than the factory trigger. And because it, coupled with some other things, gives the characteristics that I really like having. That having been said, Kirk, we've had him on the show. He has taken first place at the Rangemaster Tactical Conference the last 2 years in a row. Friend of mine, amazing shooter, beats me every time we shoot against each other. He runs stock G34s with G17 controls. So the only change that he's doing is changing out the mag release and the slide stop. And he crushes me every time we shoot against each other. In fact, he just posted the other day, he was actually got to practice because he doesn't get to do very much of that just due to the nature of his job, and ran like a 379 fast drill. Which, you know, the fastest I've ever done one was like a 394, and that was a while ago. So you don't need stuff to make you a good shooter. You absolutely don't. There's plenty of much better shooters than me who run stock, you know, run stock guns just fine. So as far as like where's the benefit, what I have found for me personally is that when I set a gun up the way that I want it, my performance is more consistent and it requires less concentration on my part to get the performance that I expect out of myself. That having been said, it's not gonna fix any egregious errors that I have. And additionally, what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, a large portion of the aftermarket triggers that are available negatively impact reliability in really bad ways. Either the gun doesn't work, or it's not drop safe anymore, or, you know, it goes full auto when you press the trigger. And so, yeah, that's just stuff you need to be aware of. Here, I'll pick back up on that. We got to go to break. Right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better! So, before the break, we were talking about triggers, and I kind of was talking specifically to Glocks, but, you know, it's kind of true of some other stuff. Aftermarket triggers are fine. Just know that if you're a really bad shooter, they're probably not going to make you any less of a bad shooter. You also need to be aware that there are some companies that make products that consistently, do not perform well. And, you know, even some of them are really well known, and sell a lot of stuff. So you can't just use like, well, there's a lot of these out there as a yardstick for what is good and what is not good. Also too, I know there's this big fascination with like reducing pre-travel and triggers right now. I personally am not a fan of that for multiple reasons. So it's kind of like your mileage may vary, right?
Yeah. Okay. Jeff Street asked about the viability or lack thereof of a defensive handgun pelvic shots.
There are times and places where it makes sense to pick a different targeting zone. If you're going to go for a pelvic shot, just understand that that is not something that is taking someone out of the fight. That is something that is limiting their mobility and maybe giving you the opportunity to change your position and get a more effective hit on them. So, because I know all sorts of people that have gotten hit you know, in an extremity or something like that, lost mobility, and then gone on to kill the individual that shot them. So are there situations where it makes sense? Yes. We actually talk about them in the class that we teach as far as when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate. But just understand it is a limited application technique for very, very specific reasons, and would not be my first choice at all. You know, what do you have anything to add with that? Or
I agree. Well, in very select circumstances, would that be my first choice? And then the main one being the other, you know, a headshot or a center chest shot is just simply not available to me for whatever reason.
Right.
But otherwise, no.
So, what else we got?
Joseph Young asked, what, if anything, do you do for physical fitness? With cardiovascular disease being the most likely thing to kill most of us, it seems like more shooters should be spending more time focusing on their health rather than their split times. Just curious what your thoughts were.
I spend a lot of time sitting in a car, driving places, and eating food that I shouldn't eat. Being honest. I'm trying to make an effort to work more on PT. And I've at various points in the last couple of years, what generally ends up happening with me is I do really well for 4-5 months at a time. lose a lot of weight, get in better shape, and then I get stuck on a project that requires me to travel for 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time and work 16-hour days, and I fall off the wagon. So should more shooters be taking physical fitness seriously? Absolutely. I'm tell you right now, I'm much more likely to drop over dead one day due to, you know, like you said, heart disease, than ever get into a gunfight in a Walmart parking lot. So it's one of those things, too, where, and myself included, I'm just as guilty of this as anyone else. You know, I come up with excuses as far as, you know, I can't do this because of X, Y, Z. I mean, are some of them valid? Sure. But at the end of the day, I'm still going to be dead, younger than I could have been, versus had I made more time to do this. So should people do it? Yes. I haven't figured out a way to consistently incorporate that into my lifestyle. And I don't know what the answer is, because if I did know what the answer is, I would have done it at this point. But it kind of is what it is right now. And I'm not saying that, like, I accept that as, like, how it will always be, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, and consistency is hard. I mean, obviously, we work together a lot. We travel a lot. And I lift. I lift free weights when I'm home. And I try very hard to be conscientious of my diet. And I am by no means out of shape, really, or, you know, overweight or anything. But that consistency is really hard when you keep the schedule that we keep. But lifting weights has been helpful. Lots of walking, swimming is something that I do as well to kind of just add a little bit more cardio to the
weightlifting,
the weightlifting aspect of it. But I think everyone could do better just being stronger. I've got osteoporosis in my family as well, so bone health is something that, you know, I'm going to need that when I get older. So.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
And for, you know, so like, I was doing much better before they closed the gym that was near my house. And like the next closest one is literally 40 minutes further. So it's like, well, darn.
Yeah, yoga. I actually on the road, I'll try and find some time to do a little yoga in a hotel room or something. Does it always happen when it's, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm crashing, you know, after a 20-hour day? No, but I try. Okay. Matt Kadart asked, do you see any utility with polymer blend knives like the TDI Shark Bite or the VZ Daggers, or is the material too easily compromised?
Well, what a lot of people don't realize about stuff like that is they are specific tools for specific environments and specific missions. So if you work somewhere where they have like metal detectors, and it's not illegal for you to illegal carry there, but there are negative social connotations with being caught with a weapon, then yes, stuff like that becomes useful. It's not an everyday knife. I mean, like I have a ceramic knife from Special Circumstances Inc. that I use for situations like that, but it's not the knife that it's not even the defensive knife that I carry all the time. You know, the one that I carry all the time is generally a titanium carbon fiber blend. Wow, that sounds really cool. Also, by Special Circumstances, I just said it out loud, and I'm like, wow, we're like in the space age.
It does sound kind of cool.
Yeah. You know, so like selecting stuff because you have a use for it versus, wow, this is like this neat thing that other people are doing. That's kind of important here. So is there a reason to have one of those? Yeah. If you have a reason to have one of those, and if you don't, then no, it's probably not doing anything that you need it to do. And those things aren't designed as a general purpose knife. They're just not, you know?
I need to get one. I really want one.
Yeah.
Lee Sharp says, work requires a lot of driving, visiting multiple states, and frequent trips into gun-free zones. What are some good resources to make sure I'm good with the law and other legal self-defense tools?
The one that I like the most, and I've got it on my phone here, is called the CCW app. So it's literally, it's available on iOS. I have no affiliation with these people. And it takes your current, you can put in like where, you know, I have a permit from this state and this state and this state or whatever, and we'll give you a map of where you're good to carry. And then if you click on that state, it will give you all the applicable laws for that state. It's just very handy. I use it all.
When you're standing in a parking lot.
Yeah. I use it all the time. Melody and I just used it in Georgia. Hey, do we have to inform? And that is by...
Do we need to report?
If you look in the App Store, it's actually by Workman Consulting LLC. And it's just really an amazing resource. So
be aware, too, though, that certain states have different justifications for lethal force and different ideas of what lethal force is. So don't just stop at knowing what your permit can do.
Yeah.
And that there's not a good app for that. You might actually have to go to, you know, state statutes. Maybe that's an app opportunity, John.
Mm.
You should make an app for it.
Well, we'll see. But anyway... I believe that takes us right to the end of the show. So, you know, thanks again, guys. Make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. I hope Joe overlays like some easy listening music on this one just because I'm like, yay. Anyway, thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week.